All this week, my colleague Rob Dillard has been exploring what it means to be a caregiver in Iowa. This hour, we wrap up the series by talking with a variety of caregivers in our state about their challenges. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this hour, John Hale of the Iowa Caregivers Association. Rich Hahn's 10-year-old son, Nick, has autism. He's here to tell us about caregiving in that situation. Also, Terry Corio, an RN who works in hospice palliative care. And Lisa Davis of Luther Care Services, who works with dementia patients. Are you a caregiver? Join our discussion this hour, right after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, my colleague here at Iowa Public Radio, Rob Dillard, has been exploring what it means to be a caregiver in Iowa as a part of the Being in Iowa series. And so this hour, as we like to do after one of the weeks with this series, we like to wrap up the series by talking with a variety of caregivers in our state in this case. And to kick things off, Rob Dillard joins me in the studio. Rob, you've been asking the question all this week in a variety of ways and a variety of answers. What does it mean to be a caregiver in the state? You've had many moving stories, which we've been enjoying throughout the week. Why did you pick caregivers for this series? Because to my recollection, this is the first group in the Being in Iowa series that is defined by work.
That's right, Ben. Most of the segments of this series over the last 3 years now almost have been about small segments of the population. This is actually a very large segment of the population. It's the biggest workforce in the state, those doing it as a part of their occupation. And it also involves almost every family at some point in the state. Many thousands of family members are caring for loved ones at home. And as I thought about focusing on this group, I thought about my own life and how many times I've been involved with caretakers, with loved ones, with family members, with dear friends. And I just kept remembering those scenes of people tending to the needs of people in sometimes very desperate straits. And it just sounded like there would be some powerful stories within that.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a cliche to say unsung heroes, but these are our unsung heroes, aren't they, for our families in our most vulnerable times?
Absolutely, and they fit the description I've used throughout the Being in Iowa, is trying to shine a light on people who don't normally get the kind of attention they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Did you find reporting this, being involved in this in the weeks that you researched and interviewed all these families and caretakers, yourself getting caught up in the emotions of being a caregiver?
Oh my, Ben, I can't tell you how many takes I would often have to make as I tried to read a story and record my voice into it, as I would crack every turn. I would try to wrap it up, and then suddenly I would get this emotion in my voice, and I go, no, I gotta keep a distance here and re-record it. But yes, it was really privileged to meet everyone along the way.
Rob Dillard, thank you. We'll leave it there and connect this hour with some of the people you talked to in a little bit longer conversation. Rob Dillard of Iowa Public Radio, thanks so much for another installment of this tremendous series, Rob.
You're welcome, Ben.
A reminder that you can listen back if you're saying, well, I only heard one or two of those. We had five of them this week. Every day this week, Rob Dillard with a new facet of being a caregiver in Iowa. And, of course, they're all on our website. You can listen to them or download them as a podcast. Always, as always, go to iowapublicradio.org. And we want to reach out to caregivers who are listening this hour. Tell us about your biggest challenges. What gives you satisfaction as a caregiver? Perhaps there's an instance in your time as a caregiver that told you, this is why I'm doing it. This is why I make a difference. We want to hear those little anecdotes, those stories this hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. First guest we have in our caregiver selection here, Terry Corio is with us. Terry is an RN in our studio in Des Moines at the moment. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
You're a certified hospice palliative nurse working for HCI Care Services. Let's address one of the common perceptions people must have of you as a caregiver working in hospice is that people would think it would be a depressing profession dealing with patients who are facing the end of their lives. But you, as was brought out in Rob's piece, really enjoy it. You've been doing it for 10 years. Why?
It's a privilege to work with patients and families at this point in their lives. And there is comfort in witnessing a peaceful ending.
Mm-hmm. So is there such a thing in hospice as a good death?
Yes, peaceful, with symptoms controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
With surrounded by family if they wish to be there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How would you describe hospice nursing as set apart from other types of nursing? What do you have to be or do that's really quite different than other nursing?
Well, that's a good question. At HCI Care Services, which is formerly Hospice of Central Iowa, we are certified, as you mentioned, and so that is a test that we take every 4 years to maintain that certification, and that's a requirement after we start there and have been employed for 3 years. In addition to the nurses being certified, the aides are certified as well in hospice mm-hmm. care.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the emotional challenges of this? Because you become very close to a patient and his or her family over weeks or even months, and then at one point say goodbye.
There is sadness. That is normal. But again, I will just say that there is comfort in that peaceful ending. And we do miss those patients and we do miss those families.
Mm-hmm. When you have a person newly becoming a caregiver in the area of hospice, in your organization perhaps, do you see them having to grapple with the emotional side of your work?
Yes.
Coming to terms with it, as you know what I mean?
Yes. But we have a great support system, and we use a team approach. And with that support, I think that helps.
Mm-hmm. Some hospice care is in-home, and some communities have a hospice center. What would you say the difference is in that? What difference does that make in the caregiving, whether that's given in the home or in a center?
At our center, it allows family members to be family members and to let us do the caregivers, as opposed to the family member trying to give the care and be present at the same time, and then they get exhausted. That's what we have to offer at the Kavanaugh Houses.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in that piece with Rob how I think you even used the word selfish, that you were attracted to hospice work because you're looking for answers to your own life and to be at peace with what all of us face, an end to life.
I actually think that was the volunteer that said that.
But I got mixed up, sorry.
That's okay. But that was a very good point. Yes, we're all faced with this at some point.
Mm-hmm. Has hospice work then changed you in the way you think about life and the end of life?
It probably has, because I see it as being more of a peaceful, normal event that we will all go through.
Okay. Terry Corio is with us. Please stand by in our Des Moines studio. Joining us by phone, Lisa Davis is with us, a certified nursing assistant for Luther Care Services. And Lisa, hi. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Yes, we just got you connected. Lisa, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on our caregiving show. You work with patients suffering from dementia. And you've been working for 39 years as a CNA, working with dementia patients, I understand, for over 8 years.
Yes.
I'm sure you heard the news that we heard a few days ago that the number of people with Alzheimer's disease in the U.S. expected to triple in the next 40 years. So this is an area that we really have to concentrate on. Many of us will be facing this. Lisa, tell me, as a certified nursing assistant working with dementia patients, what does your day typically consist of?
Well, I assist my residents with the activities of daily living. If they need help dressing, I dress them. If they need help with brushing their teeth, combing their hair, walking, eating, a sense of dignity. Our lives are pretty much like everybody else's. It's just we have a little bit of dementia going on.
Right.
So
talk
more eventful.
Right. Talk about keeping dignity. Why is it easy to slip away from dignity with someone who is suffering from dementia?
Well, that's a really good question. When you have dementia, you no longer have total control of your capacities anymore. You might drift in and out. We help to guide them to a better day, a feeling of worth, a sense of accomplishment, some independence, some fun. You know, we love them.
Mm. How much of your work, Lisa, involves the family?
A lot.
Helping the family cope with a loved one. They are observing someone they have known for perhaps decades, a family member. The person is slowly slipping away from the person that they used to be, losing some capacities progressively, memories, cognitive abilities.
Yes.
What advice, how do you approach family members who are having great difficulties with that?
Lots of explanation, lots of hugs, lots of it's okays. Family members do struggle a lot. Mom doesn't recognize me anymore. Dad doesn't want to see me anymore. Well, we as caregivers can assure them when they walk out that door, their family's going to be taken care of. We can also give them any little thing that happens. If it, you know, mom talked today. Dad walked down the hall. She finished her food. She smiled. She laughed. We can give them their day-to-day things, little things that mean a lot, and also help to console them when mom doesn't recognize them or dad wants nothing to do with them or grandma or grandpa. We're kind of the go-between, and we can fill in the parts that they missed and help their time with them be more enjoyable and more understanding. We have a support group at work for the families to go to to help them deal with and understand what's going on with their loved ones.
And as we see from those projections for the next 40 years, more and more families will be dealing with other family members who will be...
Absolutely, and they're getting younger. That's, you know, the dementia is starting younger, so...
What are the earliest ages you're seeing it?
Late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty young, you know.
Yes,
most
it is.
Of my life, I've been from 80 to 100, you know, and now we're seeing younger ones. And, you know, it's a sad thing, but it's something we truly need to work on to maybe help come up with a cure or at least to train our people to know how to better understand and better care for these people.
Talk about that. Talk about the training that goes into the type of work you have as a caregiver for dementia patients.
We have many, many specialists that come to my facility at least, and give us different ways of coping, what to expect, how to deal with the different behaviors, the different aspects of dementia. I'm fortunate in where I work is that we truly strive to take care of our residents and our families. They give us every absolute kind of training that they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
There's every case is different. Every person is different. There are so many situations that you need to at least touch base on to maybe know how to handle.
Do you feel that as a certified nursing assistant, your training is adequate, or could there be more put in place?
My training, I feel, is adequate because I've been doing it so many years. for our younger group that is coming in, I feel we need more specialized training. They need more realistic training. You know, you're not coming in the distance dementia. Well, you're not coming in to help grandma walk to the dining room. They need a realistic idea of exactly what dementia is and what they're going to be doing day to day.
And so when you see new people come in to do the same work that you've been doing for many years, the specific challenges that you see they face as new people entering the field are what? That they just have a false impression of what it is to care for someone with dementia.
Absolutely.
In what way? In what way?
Well, okay, take an 18-year-old that comes to work. You know, she's all up in the air, going to take care of this person, and gets smacked in the face.
Literally smacked in the face.
Literally smacked in the face. You have behaviors. And sometimes that'll scare someone, you know, and they need to be taught to expect those things, to deal with them, not take them personally, and to help your resident overcome whatever is scaring them or making them want to act out.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean by realistic training. Getting how to react to getting smacked in the face.
Right.
Mm. Lisa Davis, stay with us, certified nursing assistant with us, a woman who cares for dementia patients. We're talking about being a caregiver in Iowa, and we want to get on to some other caregivers in the course of this hour. I want to reach out to you, too. If you're a caregiver, tell us about your biggest challenges and your biggest satisfactions as a caregiver. Perhaps there's an instance, a little story you can tell us as a caregiver that told you, this is why I do it. This is why I make a difference. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Now joining us also, John Hale is a public policy consultant for the Iowa Caregivers Association in our Des Moines studio. John, welcome to our program.
Ben, good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you on the program, the Iowa Caregivers Association. For those not familiar with it, who are you?
We are an organization that's existed for 20 years in Iowa. We are the leading voice in Iowa for direct care workforce. We're one of the leading and most visible voices in the nation for the direct care workforce. It's our mission to advocate for the direct care workforce, to educate the public about the direct care workforce, to improve the lives of the direct care workforce, and to improve the jobs of the direct care workforce, to encourage more people to look at the direct care job as a good job, a place that they can start and a place that they can stay to make a good career.
What numbers are we talking about who are direct care workers in Iowa?
The numbers are surprising, if not amazing. There are 73,000 workers, direct care workers in the state of Iowa. They represent Iowa's largest occupation. Mm-hmm. That is one of Iowa's fastest growing occupations. Projections by Iowa Workforce Development and the Iowa Department of Public Health say that 73,000 size of workforce needs to grow to 88,000 in the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. 15,000 additional workers will be needed in the next 5 years.
So Iowa caregivers giving care to all sorts of ailments and conditions?
Well, we exist solely to support the workforce. We do not provide direct services to individuals in Iowa. We exist to support those 73,000 workers, do whatever we can to make their jobs better, to provide them with the skills and the knowledges that they need so that they can provide the best possible care and services to the Iowans that they serve.
I understand that turnover in direct care as a profession is a big problem. Why so much turnover?
Turnover is a huge problem, an understated problem, an invisible problem to the vast majority of Iowans. But if they fully understood this, they would be surprised and shocked and possibly outraged. Turnover in the direct care field runs 50-60% annually. As has been indicated earlier, Lisa indicated this, that she sees people come into the workforce not fully prepared, and they leave very, very quickly because they don't understand the work, they don't like the work, they're not really well suited for the work. The realities of this work, Ben, are things that would not encourage people to come in and stay in the workforce. The jobs are low-pay jobs. They offer few benefits. The training is often, as Lisa indicated, inadequate. The work, as Terry indicated, is physically challenging work, emotionally draining work. There's high incidence of on-the-job injury in the work. And for the people who are the unlicensed workers like Lisa, the people who are not overseen or credentialed by the state of Iowa, these are people who simply do not have a lot of, or many at all, career options within that field of direct care. So many of them leave the profession, not that they don't like the work, but they do like the work, but they leave because they need to make a decent living. They have to support a family. And you hear so many direct care workers say that I love the work. This is a great profession for me. However, I can't make a good living at it, so I'm going to have to leave it.
And I understand, John Hale, that you would like to see our Iowa legislature take some action to remedy the problems that you've just outlined.
Action is necessary. The status quo really is no longer acceptable. When you look at just the workforce development challenge that we face in Iowa, 15,000 additional workers are needed. We have to figure out ways to encourage 15,000 additional Iowans to come into this workforce and stay in this workforce. We have to figure out ways for the 73,000 that are currently in the workforce to have reasons to stay, to give them reasons to stay. Mm-hmm. So we do need some legislation. We need a public policy solution. And I'm happy to say that next week there's going to be a bill introduced in the Iowa legislature that will begin to do some of the exact things that we've talked about, to give a direct care worker, the direct care workforce, more training, to give them more status, to give them to just send a message to them that they're important. The work they do is important enough to be overseen by the state of Iowa, to be given credentials that show that they are, in fact, fully trained to do the work. So this legislation that's going to be introduced is going to be extremely important. We'll need a lot of interest and support from Iowans talking to their individual legislators to make that bill a reality.
Extremely important. I think we can all agree on that. But in an era of tight budgets and ballooning health care costs, you must face a headwind in getting these things through. What are the costs attached?
Well, we face a headwind, but I think the best response to the concern about cost is, what are we currently spending and what are we spending that money for? When we talk about turnover, for example, Ben, this again is a figure from the Iowa Department of Public Health. In 2011, the state of Iowa spent $189 million. The state of Iowa, $189 million just to support and to fund the cost of turnover of workers every year.
We could be much more efficient.
We could be much more efficient. Let's target that money and use it to invest in the workforce rather than to replace people that leave the workforce.
John Hale is with us, public policy consultant for the Iowa Caregivers Association. John, please stay with us in our Des Moines studio. Terry Corio is with us, an RN in our Des Moines studio as well, certified in hospice palliative nursing. And also joining us by phone, Lisa Davis, a certified nursing assistant working with dementia patients. All sorts of caregivers on our show today. To conclude the series by my colleague Rob Dillard. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk to Rich Hahn. Rich's 10-year-old son Nick has autism, and we'll talk about his caregiving. Perhaps you'd like to share your story as a caregiver or as someone who's been given care. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. All about caregivers, back in just a few minutes. So good to have you with us on this noon hour of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we are exploring what it means to be a caregiver in Iowa. At the same time, we're celebrating caregivers in Iowa of all sorts, and it's quite a large group. Tens of thousands of us in our communities are caregivers, and we're looking at what it means to be a caregiver and what challenges are facing our caregivers, what different types of caregivers there are in our state. We have a number of guests who represent different areas. Terry Corio in our Des Moines studio, an RN who specializes in hospice nursing. Lisa Davis, looking at a certified nursing assistant who works with dementia patients. John Hale is with us, public policy consultant for the Iowa Caregivers Association to give us a big picture view of some of the concerns among Iowa caregivers. And we want to have you join our conversation. If you're a caregiver, if you want to appreciate a caregiver who has been in your life or who is in your life, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Before we do get to those calls, joining our guests, also Rich Hahn is with us. Hi, Rich, in our Des Moines studio. Hi.
Hello.
You are a caregiver for your son, Nick, who has autism, and we heard about you in Rob's piece earlier this week, you and your wife with Nick. You also have a daughter as well. How early in his life, did you and your wife become aware that something was different about Nick?
It's kind of a tough question. I mean, when we look back at it, you know, we should have probably realized earlier. But at the time, I guess, you know, we would talk to our pediatrician about certain things, and always just a boy, or sister does all his talking for him, things like that.
So he was not talking?
He had some speech delay, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that was probably one of the first things that was brought up to us by a caregiver. And so I think as parents, you're just kind of naive to those things, or you know,
right.
You know, ignorance is bliss, I guess.
Yeah, you hope at some point they'll catch up in their development. When was Nick's diagnosis?
He was diagnosed at just before his third birthday.
Mm-hmm. With high-functioning autism, I understand.
Well, the diagnosis at that time was actually very dismal. It was his diagnosis at that time was considered a very, very low-functioning form of autism. But with, you know, you could take him today to 10 different doctors and you're going to get 10 different diagnoses.
A lot still to be found out about autism, as you know better than anyone else, I'm sure, Rich.
Absolutely. You know, the latest statistics have it at 1 in 88 families are affected by autism, 1 in 54 boys.
Mm. When that diagnosis came, what was your reaction, you and your wife's reaction? A relief that there had been finally a diagnosis or something else?
Probably something else. It was, you know, it's hard news to take, and you know, especially as a dad and your boy, and you think about, you know, the relationship that you have with your son, and you know, it was something that I totally had to readdress in my mind and shape given the reality that we were facing. But we had really great people. Bendy Brown from the AEA was one of the ones that had talked to us, and she made us realize very quickly that it had absolutely nothing to do with us. It was about Nicholas, and we needed to get ourselves together for the fight we had ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. How is parenting your son, Nick, with autism compared to your daughter, Natalie, I believe, who is not autistic?
No, Natalie does not have autism. Natalie is, from what you'd heard on the radio, she's a very sweet girl, has a heart of gold, loves her brother, great relationship. So she's a typical kind of bratty teenager at times. Mm. That's Natalie, but she's an amazing girl.
And helps out tremendously.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine doing it without her. We're going to have to figure that out, though, when time to go to college comes around.
Right. Well, one of the major things you and your wife, I understand your wife Jennifer, grapple with is coordinating Nick's care. Why is this a struggle?
Well, it is very, very difficult to care for Nick. He's aggressive. He, in addition to his autism, he has pretty severe OCD. So something as simple as walking through a doorway at times can be challenging. So.
Right.
You have to have the patience of a saint. And, you know, so finding people, again, you know, we've had our discussions around caregivers and finding someone who is, you know, willing to do that for the type of pay that's involved with it. You know, they're wonderful, wonderful people, the associates at schools, people through Heartland, different areas, the homestead, they're fantastic people. But really, I mean, we're the only ones that know truly what it's like to have a day in the life and, you know, in the Hahn House and you know, it's something that we, you know, we fight our way through.
I understand you as a way to cope with situations that may arise in public with people who are not quite aware of Nick's condition. You hand out cards explaining that Nick has autism. Well, when do you do that and why?
Here, I'm pulling one out of my wallet right now.
Yeah, go ahead and read it.
It says, educate yourself. My son is not misbehaving. He has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org, and it says, don't judge, educate.
Mm-hmm. What is the reaction you get to those cards typically?
people will kind of just have probably an embarrassed or an ashamed look on their face. It's weird or awkward, the looks that you get, or you know, I've been we're getting a haircut, and my wife was made to feel pretty bad because of how Nicholas was acting, and they were actually trying to correct him, and it was a bad situation. So I drove back there, and I gave him one of my cards.
So you will have people typically often admonishing you or your wife as perhaps bad parents.
Yeah, that's not uncommon at all because, you know, Nick doesn't really care too much about the world around him. I mean, he's Nick, and he's going to do and say what he's going to do and he's going to say. So,
what do you see when you look at Nick's future as he grows older?
My motto is kind of hope for the best, prepare for the worst. Right now, just because of his extreme aggressions, we hope that we're able to keep him in public school and to keep him in our home. Because of, you know, how aggressive and destructive he can be. So it's really right now just trying to hope that he can learn to deal with his feelings.
Mm-hmm. Any hopes for treatment on the horizon?
You know, there's insurance reform going on. We had our day on the Hill yesterday at the State House, you know, for insurance coverage, for some necessary services. I know you guys talked to Evan Horton, too. Right now, those services are very, very expensive, and a lot of families don't have access to them. So, yeah, those types of services and those therapies that aren't currently covered by private insurance would make a big difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Does the new healthcare law change any of that?
Right now, the coverage is for state employees only. The law they're trying to push would be for private insurance companies would have to pick it up, too, for everybody that has insurance.
Rich Hahn, thank you. Please stay with us. We want to get to our phones because we have a variety of people who want to join our conversation about being a caregiver in Iowa. Thank you for calling. Jane is joining us from Waterloo. Hi, Jane.
Well, hi.
Thank you. Are you a caregiver?
Well, I am a certified nursing assistant. I am a caregiver for my parents, and I have a unique slant on the subject, actually, and I want to thank you for recognizing those of us who are doing this work. But what I do is I interview people that are toward the end of their life to document their last wishes, and we cover topics such as how did you become the person you are, what influenced you, and what did you think your life was devoted to changing, or, you know, in your family, what would you like them to remember you for, or your church community or your community at large? And we create little books, and I'm finding it to be cathartic in the sense that the people that tell their story find that there's a great deal of peace in putting something down that will live after them.
Right. Do you find interviewing people who have lived 60, 70, 80 years or longer, that they are having things occur to them? They are voicing things that they have never really crystallized before that point.
Yeah, there's something that gives them a great deal of courage to have that opportunity. One husband and father came to terms with the loss of his son who preceded him in death, and also the fact that there was some sexual abuse in his family that everybody had hushed about, and he wanted it to stop right then and there.
Mm-hmm. He
put it down on paper. Another fella, he's not very old, but he would like the state of Iowa to know that it's time that we stop being the statistic with the largest amount of blacks incarcerated. And that's what he's devoted his life to.
Terry Corio with us, an RN. You're certified in hospice palliative nursing. This is interesting what Jane brings to the table here, because I have heard that, you know, when people are nearing the end of their life, sometimes they're hanging on because there's something that needs to be resolved. Is that correct, Terry?
Yes, we do. We do see that, and we do life review and hear some of those stories. And extended families that have been apart do end up coming back together. And it seems like patients sometimes hang on just for that.
Mm. Jane, thank you very much. And also producing a document for the family, I imagine, in that little book, Jane.
It's so great for the family. You wonder if it's going to create ripples, but it just is so such a peace-giving experience for them.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for calling and sharing that aspect that we hadn't had up to this point. Jane in Waterloo. Suzanne is joining us from Grinnell. Hi, Suzanne. Please chip in what you'd like here.
Oh, I just wanted to thank caregivers. I have two elderly parents and one who needs around-the-clock care and who has dementia. And it's the difference between a good and a bad caregiver can mean so much to the family member because, you know, my father can't communicate very well, but he can think a lot. To treat him with respect and not treat him as if he is a five-year-old is so the difference can be immense for him, and you can tell by his reaction how he's, you know, how he's taking that in. And so it means a lot to a family member that their family member is treated with respect, even though he can't do some of the simplest things for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, this harkens back, Suzanne, to what Lisa Davis was talking about in her work with dementia patients. Dignity, Lisa, wasn't that, if you're still on the line, dignity is such an important part of caregiving with dementia patients.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It certainly is.
Thank you, Suzanne, for calling from Grinnell. Let's see, is that Lisa wanting to chip in something?
No, I was just saying dignity is a very big issue, not only for the resident, also for the family. You know, to know that their loved one is treated that way.
Right.
And, you know, I do my job because I love it. And I love my people. I love my family. And to truly do this job, I think you have to do it with your heart.
We can hear that in your voice, Lisa, that you love it, that you have a passion for it, and certainly your decades of work as a CNA are a tribute to that, a testament to that. But would you have suggestions on how we can, you know, get the population, get the needed workforce we will need in the coming years? And John Hale described a ballooning of needs here. What suggestions would you have?
John is so right. We need respect as a profession. We have lost thousands of absolutely fabulous caregivers because of pay, insurance, because they can't make it in this field, even though they love it. And those are the kind of people we need, the ones who love to do this job and love the elderly or children or whatever medical aspect they're in. But we need to be treated with respect as a professional. And, you know, direct caregivers have really not been given that. So that's something I think that we need to work on.
John Hale, you're echoing that. Please do it as we wind up this hour.
Absolutely. You know, I think it all comes back to are we going to choose to invest in this workforce? And to go back to where Rob started saying that this is something that's very personal. It is. It's very personal to almost every Iowan at some point in their life, in some way or another. Their life is going to be touched by a paid professional caregiver. The only question is, when they roll the dice, are they going to get a fabulous direct care worker or one who really isn't fabulous, who's not in it for the right reason? There are some extraordinary people who do this work. We need more extraordinary people to do this work. And to do that, we've got to change the way we think about this workforce and the way we treat this workforce, to invest in them, their skills, their training, their knowledge, their pay, their benefits, treat them as professionals, value them. If we do those things, if we make those fundamental changes, I think we've got a very good chance at not only meeting Iowa's workforce needs, but really setting the standard for the nation and to be the leader in the nation and showing the rest of the states on how to deal with direct care workforce issues, how to provide better care to the people who need it. And if we can do that, we will have accomplished some very, very significant things for Iowans and for Americans.
John Hale of the Iowa Caregivers Association. Let's check back in with our phones to get some more stories of caregiving, celebrations of caregivers. Terry in Clear Lake, hi. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you. About 15 years ago, my mother had a severe stroke, and we chose together to keep her in her home, and I cared for her for about 8 years. We were an exception to the norm in that for the last 2 years of her life, we were involved with Hospice of North Iowa. And we had the best caregivers involved with them helping us in our day-to-day life. the chaplain would come in and play cribbage with mom every couple of weeks. We had the best nurse checking in on us. I just cannot say enough about those people. The volunteers that they helped us with were just fabulous people, and they became over those 2 years part of our family.
Terry, imagine for us the other end of it. If those people had not been there in your area in Clear Lake, what if that organization, a hospice, had not been there? What would you have encountered in those final years?
It would have been pretty bleak. I had a couple people ask me why we didn't put mom in a nursing home, and I don't think she would have lasted. I wouldn't have had 10 years with her if she would have been in a nursing home. It would have been pretty hard. We tried. We were lucky once we got a really good private caregiver that helped us out, and another time we found somebody that wasn't as good with mom. And, it was really hard to find good people to help. But we were lucky on more than one occasion to find good people. And without the hospice people, it would have been pretty bleak.
Terry, thank you for sharing your appreciation and your story from Clear Lake. And let's go to Stanley in Fayette. Stanley, hi.
Good morning. I became a nurse's aide in 95 for 5 years after I retired from the military. And it became more therapeutic for me than anything because now I was helping somebody with their life instead of taking life. And I really enjoyed it. The first place I worked was people that I grew up around, and I was taking care of them when they took care of me as a kid. And I was the only male there, but you know you're accepted when you end up starting to go to wedding parties for one of the girls or something else with the girls, you know. Right. And I'd like to see more males in it. And the reason I laugh is, you know, like John said, with the money, when I was making $9 an hour doing that, and I could make 22 running the bulldozer, and that was the changing thing, I'd still be in it if, you know, the pay was better.
Stanley, thank you for giving us a male perspective as a caregiver here to John Hale. Let's talk a little bit about caregiver personality. We tend to connect that with females. There we have Stanley, definitely someone cut out for this type of work.
Workers are all extraordinary people. The really good ones are all extraordinary people. The workforce in Iowa and the nation is about 90% female, but there is a growing number of men who see this as work that they should do, that they can do. But again, Stanley's point is so well taken, so well made. He can make $9 an hour as a direct care worker. His choice is to make $22 as a bulldoze operator. If a person needs to make a living, they're probably going to make the choice and be the bulldoze operator. Not the bulldoze operators aren't important people. They are. But when you put that in some context, the people caring for mom and dad, the people caring for Rich's son, the people caring for the person with early onset Alzheimer's are all extraordinary, valuable people, and we simply need to view them and treat them and compensate them in the way we value them.
A.J. is with us from Des Moines, our last caller. We don't have much time. A.J., please come forward with your story. I think you have one.
I do. My mom is a hospice worker, and I'm a teacher, and so sometimes I definitely experience the long days and you know, having a lot going on, everyone pulling you in a million different directions. And my mom, throughout my brothers and my, you know, high school experience, was always willing to go to work with a smile on her face and was always there for those families when they needed them, when they were going through those rough times, having worked at a hospice and taking care of people. And so I just wanted to say that she was such an inspiration for me, even though I'm in a completely different field. I'm not a nurse. I'm a teacher. But she was such an inspiration for me for going through that every single day with a smile on her face. It's such a blessing to so many people.
There you go, AJ. Thank you for ending our hour with a story of sort of unintended consequences, good consequences of caregivers in our midst. AJ, thank you for joining us from Des Moines.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we're winding up this hour with a series of caregivers. We've been delighted with a number of responses we've been having over the phones for this hour. Thank you very much for chipping in with your experiences. We want to thank our guests, especially Terry Corio, an RN certified in hospice palliative nursing. Terry in our Des Moines studio, thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome.
Also, Lisa Davis, a certified nursing assistant, John Hale, and Rich Hahn. Thank you very much for joining us and giving us your perspective as we celebrate and find out about being a caregiver in Iowa. Thank you all.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Caitlin's last day today. We have appreciated your care in what you give to this program and have for many months. Caitlin Fry, we'll be looking forward to hearing updates from you as you move on. Our student assistant, Caitlin, thank you so much. And technical support from Dennis Reese, executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments, your questions about this program. Perhaps you have a suggestion for a focus of a future program. We'd love to hear it. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.